Shrink Wrap Radio number 397. Dr. James Alexander interviews Dr. David Van Nuys.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Today's guest is me. We're turning the mic around today. Dr. James Alexander, Australian Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio number 341 about the hidden psychology of pain, suggested that listeners might be interested in knowing more about me, and he urged me to submit to an interview by him. I was initially reluctant, but recognized he was offering me a gift and it would be rude to turn him down. For more detail on both Dr. James Alexander and myself, please go to the show notes on shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. My name is Dr. James Alexander, and today I'm putting on the couch my favorite psychologist and probably yours too, Dr. Dave. Here's the interview. Dr. David Van Nuys, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, what a privilege it is to be on your couch for once.
Yes, well, it's turning things around a bit. And I must explain to the listeners how this has come about. A few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, I invited you to avail yourself to an interview, primarily because while you have in various interviews in the past revealed little bits and pieces about your own personal history, I consider that you're a psychologist that has grown during a very interesting, informative era in psychology. I think you were possibly a graduate student in the late 50s and embarking on your career in psychology in the 60s, and I became a psychologist during the 1980s and really grew up as a psychologist listening or reading stories about the very formative years during the 50s and 60s, the post-war era.
Okay, I need to cut in and let you know you're making me a little older than I actually am. I was a graduate student in the mid-60s.
Okay, that's great. Thanks for the correction. I don't want to rob you of any important valuable years. Nevertheless, even more interesting, you're a student during the 60s. And as I was saying to psychologists of my age group, that's a very fascinating era when psychology was taking shape as a social phenomenon that it is today. And with a bit of arm bending and cajoling, I got you to agree to make yourself the subject of an interview so that others, well, firstly, so that I could have an interesting conversation with you, which I've hankered to do for quite some time. But it also occurred to me that many other people would also be very interested in your observations and your experiences of our profession over the last few decades. So that's how it came about. And you weren't entirely sure whether you had anything of interest to offer, and I assured you that no doubt you have, and my guess is that many of the listeners will agree as well. So if we can just launch into it, and I'm wondering, Dr. Dave, do you consider yourself to be a pioneer in psychology?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for urging me to go ahead and summon up my courage and do this, and hopefully it will turn out well. Now, as to me being a pioneer, no, I don't regard myself as a pioneer, but I do see myself as having some kind of a gift, if you will, of a sort of a semi-conscious or perhaps unconscious knows for where things are going. I don't know if you did you ever see the movie Forrest Gump?
Yes, I did.
Well, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I seem to recall that there were scenes using trick photography where they inserted him, at one of the presidential inaugurals. I think you see him standing next to Kennedy or Bill Clinton or somebody, and then you see him with Elvis and a number of famous settings like that. Yeah. And so I feel a little bit like Forrest Gump in that way, of having been present for some key moments. Another way I've thought about it is that I'm an early lemming hopefully not going off the cliff with all the lemmings, but having some kind of an unconscious sense of where the crowd is going in a way, so that I'm kind of an early adopter in many situations. For example, podcasting. I started podcasting in 2005. Well, I wasn't the first podcasting by any means, but most people date the beginning of podcasting in 2005. I came a little late. It took me a while to get it all figured out. So I think my first podcast is maybe in August of 2005. My market research career, I quickly, or at some point before it was happening yet, I realized that the focus groups that I had been doing in person could perhaps be done online. And so I was among that very early group of people to do focus group market research online. In college, if I can keep going on about this, I got into motorcycles before college students in general did. Right now, it's very common in the U.S. for lots of college students to be on motorcycles. But this was well before the Japanese invasion of affordable motorcycles and before it became fashionable. And motorcycles were mostly associated with hooligans in this country. And so there weren't very many people at the Ivy League college university where I went who had motorcycles, but I got one for a period. I was also, probably one of the early adapters in terms of the psychedelic revolution, early interest in yoga before sort of spirituality caught on big time over here. So not a pioneer, but somewhere in the in the early pack.
Yes, well, it sounds like you've been on the ground floor of a lot of the social change that went on during that era. And this is part of the reason why I was very interested in getting your observations.
Sure.
What got you interested in psychology to begin with?
Well, you know, I was originally accepted into at the University of Pennsylvania into electrical engineering. And in fact, I had a full scholarship in electrical engineering, which perhaps might also help to explain my interest in podcasting and technology and so on. But I quickly figured out that my high school preparation really wasn't strong enough. And also, I don't think I had the study skills and discipline at that point in my life to take on something quite that heavy duty. So I ended up switching out of engineering very early. Fortunately, they let me keep my scholarship. I ended up majoring in creative writing, actually. And so that was my major, with a heavy dose of philosophy along the way. But I did try, as soon as I switched out of engineering, I did try taking a course in Introduction to Psychology. And I was quickly turned off to psychology. I thought that would be a real option somehow, psychology.
Dave, around what sort of year was this?
Okay, I started, I was in the class of 62, the graduating class of 62. So I guess actually I did start undergraduate in 1958. So this would have been around 58, 59.
Yep.
And so this intro to psych class was all about running rats and things like that. And so it was not at all what I imagined. The professor, I remember standing up in front of one of those tiered lecture rooms. You know, he was down at the bottom. We were up high somewhere looking down. And he said, if you're taking this class because you're hoping to figure out your own idiosyncrasies or the quirks of your friends, you're in the wrong place. Psychology is the science of the study of animal and human behavior. And it seemed like it was mostly animal behavior. And indeed, that's what had drawn me to take a class in psychology was, yes, I was interested in my own personal quirks and idiosyncrasies as well as my friends, as were, I think, a whole lot of people in that class.
Absolutely. And so, you have to wonder how many people were turned off and how many potentially great careers in psychology were discouraged during that era of radical behaviorism.
Yes, I think you're right.
Hmm. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, so you might wonder, well, how did you get into psychology then? So I was initially turned off, but then I think it was the summer before my junior year, I heard about clinical psychology as a profession from one of my high school buddies that I got together with. Well, I had never heard the term clinical psychology. I had no idea what it was. So I asked, well, what is clinical psychology? And he said, well, it's just like being a psychiatrist, only you don't have to go to medical school. And I had actually considered psychiatry just kind of on a hearsay basis, but but I ruled out medical school. But I thought, well, that sounds intriguing. That sounds like maybe something I could do. Tell me more. He said, well, I'm a Rogerian. And I said, oh, what's that? And he said, well, it's named after this fellow Carl Rogers, a psychologist. And basically, he has this theory of therapy where whatever the person says, you kind of just repeat back to them what they've said. And I thought, well, that sounds like something I could do. So as strange as it sounds and as naive as I was, that really kind of planted the seed to consider something called clinical psychology. And so as I looked into it, I found that one of the doorways into that would be to take a class in abnormal psychology, or what's also known as psychopathology. Mm-hmm. And that was indeed a course where I could find out about my idiosyncrasies, frighteningly so, as well as my friends. Mm-hmm. And I loved that class, and I threw myself on the mercy of that professor later. I think I might have taken one or two other psychology classes. And I threw myself on his mercy to write me a letter of recommendation out of the hundreds of people who had been in his course, which he did. And as a result, later, after, you know, initially I got that degree in clinical creative writing and graduated and took a job. My first job at that summer job really was going to be a full-time job at a department store, and I was a advertising copywriter. And so I realized, oh my God, I need to find more of a career. And so I applied to some schools looking to get into clinical psychology. I discovered I was going to need to get into a master's program if I had any hope, and then later into a doctoral program. So I applied to a number of master's programs. And again, in my characteristic fashion of deep study, I chose the University of Montana in Missoula by virtue of having looked at some catalogs of graduate schools, and the picture on the catalog showed two guys throwing a grizzly bear into the back of a pickup truck. And I thought, surely this place will let me in with my mediocre grades and no major in undergraduate major in psychology. And indeed they did, but only provisionally. They said, well, you'll have to take some makeup classes, undergraduate classes, and you'll have to really apply yourself and get straight A's.
Right.
So that's what I did. I went to, got into the University of Montana in Missoula, applied myself very much and got straight A's. But they also had me teaching an intro to psychology class right out of, you know, I just graduated with a BA, not in psychology. So I was reading a chapter or two ahead of students, of my students. And that's probably served me well in the podcast as well. I learned to be a quick study, but a very anxious one.
Mm.
But what drew me to the idea of becoming a therapist, very naively, because I had never been in therapy, but I had always been one of those people that people trusted, and of course, lots of people who go into this profession have the same story. Yeah, people would confide in me and they'd say, you're the only one I've ever told this to. You're the only one I would trust to tell this to. And so that made me feel like I would be a natural. And I was my interest in creative writing was really that I was interested in what I call the brass tacks of human existence, the real deep stuff of what it is to be a human being. And I thought that being a therapist would be about that, that it would be an opportunity to be involved with people at that level.
Yeah. What sort of position in society did psychology hold at that time? You said that you'd never heard of clinical psychology before, and you had a rude shock when you attended your first psychology class. So I gather that psychology was not a prominent discipline or profession at that time.
Well, I don't know that clinical psychology was. In fact, I think clinical psychology as a profession was born in the U.S. in post-World War II. And since World War II ended in 45, you know, and there was something called the Boulder Conference, and in which the profession of clinical psychologists got shaped. So in a way, yes, I was a child of the 50s, and I started college in the late 50s, in graduate school in the middle 60s. So I was really an inheritor of the psychology of the 50s in a way, as I began to get into it. And so that was mainly one that had a strong public perception that was linked strongly to psychoanalysis. There had been very popular movies, which I don't know if any of the listeners will recognize the titles, The Three Faces of Eve, David and Lisa, and even earlier one called The Snake Pit, about a horrible mental asylum. And then there was a very popular book that I read called The 50-Minute Hour, which was a very well-written, sort of fictionalized account of a psychotherapist giving kind of very dramatic case histories, a number of them as like short stories, and really fascinating. And so that had really captured the public imagination, I think, and really defined what a psychologist who was a therapist was in the public imagination, including my imagination. But then, as I found out in college and then later in graduate school, behaviorism was just starting to be a public force. A public force due primarily, it was an academic force already, but it was starting to be a public force partly because of a utopian novel that B.F. Skinner wrote called Walden 2, which I also read at the time. It had a very wide impact, and it had a strong impression on me as a young, impressionable guy. And I'm still a pretty impressionable guy, so as my listeners probably recognize. So that's kind of what the public perception was at that time.
So, again, this is it's a fascinating era for me as a psychologist with also an interest in history, that there was the popular perception of applied psychology was a vision of psychoanalytic therapy.
Yes.
Whereas in academic circles for quite some time, the behaviorist revolution was well and truly underway, and that was becoming more popular via Walden 2 from B.F. Skinner.
Well, in academic circles, of course, it wasn't so much Walden 2 as all of the research and all of his students who were out evangelizing in academia, but in a very doctrinaire way.
Yes. And then also you had this third force to psychology, the humanistic psychology, beginning to evolve, I guess, around the era when you were beginning your career in psychology.
It didn't get into my awareness, really, until I had graduated. Until I graduated with my PhD, or right around that time. So that wasn't until around 90. It didn't get into my awareness till around, say, 69, 70.
Okay. What did you find appealing about humanistic psychology at that time?
Well, I was trained in a psychoanalytic model at the University of Michigan. I got into the clinic, was admitted to the clinical psychology program from after getting my master's in Montana, where they had no clinical psychology at that program. In fact, there was no master's level training that one could get as a therapist at that time. So, you know, I discovered I had to get a PhD, and I would have to go on to do that if I wanted to be a therapist. And just by happenstance, I got into Michigan, which was a major school to get into on the one hand, but also one of the last bastions in academic psychology of the psychoanalytic point of view at that time. And I don't know if it's still held there or now. I would really tend to doubt it. I should check up on that, but I would really tend to doubt it because the more scientific model really won the day. So I was trained in the psychoanalytic model, but I really rejected it. It seemed too pathologizing to me, too authoritarian, and plus it was the 60s, and we were generally rebellious anyway, you know. So I was looking into alternatives. And one of the alternatives that was floating around at the University of Michigan at that time, particularly among the graduate students and junior faculty, was the encounter group movement. And so that was really my first introduction to what you might call humanistic psychology, or a spin-off of humanistic psychology, as I first was a member of an encounter group, which just blew my mind, and then became an encounter group leader. And of course, some of the values of both the encounter group movement and humanistic psychology were a here and now kind of orientation, a self-disclosure kind of orientation, a valuing of personal experience, of subjective experience, and an emphasis on the importance of authenticity and mutual feedback. Those were all values that I resonated with very, very quickly, that I didn't find represented in the training model of that I was being exposed to at the University of Michigan. And so it had great appeal to me as a young person. It was by virtue of the focus group that I was encounter group that I was in, I got tons of praise for who I am, in essence, which I never got from my faculty. Right. And so I felt, you know, where I had a lot of self-doubt about, geez, had I chosen the right place to go? Had I chosen the right profession? Was I really suited for this? The feedback that I was getting from the encounter groups that I was in was, oh, you're a wonderful person, a wonderful listener, you're empathetic, you're, you know. So it was total confirmation.
Dave, I imagine during that era, to receive that kind of feedback was possibly would have been an unusual experience for anybody. My guess is that family cultures and the prevailing culture of the time was not so aware of the need to give children or young people positive feedback, and there would have been something, I imagine, something very unique about being in an encounter group where there was an attempt at total honesty. And, you know, a valuing of people that perhaps was not so much part of the prevailing culture. Is that what it was like?
Yeah, that's very accurate. And so it was really a mind blower for those of us who had the benefit of that experience. It really, when I came out of my first encounter group, which it might have been all night. I think it might have been one day. I think it was a kind of one day, one night marathon group. And by the time it was over, I was high. I don't think I'd ever had a psychedelic at that point, but I was high, and I was accosting people who I only barely knew, you know, saying, let's sit down and have a conversation. I don't think we've ever deeply shared. And it was a little bit much, but they were intrigued.
Did you attend any naked encounter groups?
No, I don't think I did. No, not not of a formal nature.
As a student in the 80s, we heard some amazing stories about naked encounter groups, which we never experienced ourselves.
But. Yeah, no, I never did do that. I didn't lead any, and I didn't go to any. Okay. But I was, you know, I did fully partake of the 60s, but not that particular
format. Yeah, we'll get on to that shortly, because I think that's of great interest as well. One of the theories that I've got in terms of the evolution of psychology, when I started being a student in the early 80s, I was also quite enthralled by Carl Rogers. And the kind of values that underpinned his approach was yes. extremely appealing to me. And when I began practicing by the late 80s, my postgraduate training was primarily in a cognitive behavioral approach, which, you know, I learned and was able to regurgitate for purposes of getting my qualifications. So I tried a bit of that, and also tried client-centered counselling approaches, and I found that it wasn't terribly effective. Now, it may have been something to do with me, and it may not have been the method at all, but I've often wondered whether our culture has evolved a lot since the 1940s and 50s when Rogers was developing these ideas, you know, his approach, and I imagine it would have been very unusual, particularly for men in the 1940s and 50s and maybe probably the first part of the 60s as well, to be given the space to be able to reflect about their experience, to be able to actually talk about their experience, their inner world. I imagine that would have been a very unusual place for particularly men to find themselves in, and I can imagine in relation to the prevailing culture, it would have been a unique opportunity, and I can well imagine it was highly therapeutic, whereas these days it seems that everybody's talking about themselves all over the place.
Right.
You know, obviously in a sort of a me generation and culture, there seems to be something less unique about the opportunity to explore explore your inner world. So I think the culture has changed somewhat.
Yes, and in fact, I would say that, you know, people ask, well, what happened to humanistic psychology? Where did it go? Well, to some degree, it got absorbed by the larger culture, and some of the things that were very unique and exciting then are sort of ho-hum now and taken for granted, as you're saying.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think that's very much the case. Yes, and I just wonder whether, you know, there's been so many exciting developments in psychotherapy, and a lot of them, you know, the more experiential approaches in psychotherapy, which is still what holds my attention, still seem to have an underpinning of the same values that Rogers was talking about. And a lot of the micro skills are still there as well.
Yes.
But it seems to have gone beyond that. I kind of gather that it seems to me that our culture now requires more than just simply a space to reflect, because we tend to do, like you said, it's been absorbed into the mainstream culture, and we all tend to do that to a certain degree anyway.
Yes. Yeah, I think that Rogers is undervalued. He's, you know, not as well known and not as much appreciated for the impact that he's had. And as I just said, for humanistic psychology generally, I think a lot of his notions have been kind of absorbed and are taken for granted. But yeah. he really influenced how psychotherapy is done, even by cognitive behavior therapists, people who practice that. Behaviorism, I think, morphed, fortunately, over time, and became, I think, it's become much more inclusive, much more willing to draw upon whatever seems to work. And it became clear, you know, one of the good developments, I think, is that research has shown that the hard lines that were being drawn between the different schools of therapy turned out to be not as important as some of the skills, as you were mentioning, skill-based, kind of became more accepted skills of listening and empathizing and somehow communicating a quality of being that is somewhat healing in and of itself, I think, for the person on the other end.
Certainly, yep. Now, another thing of interest to me is, I think it was probably in the mid to late 90s, I was lecturing psychology at a local university, and I think I was taking doing a unit on personality theories, where I would teach the students the big theories in psychology, the big models in psychology. And when it came to humanistic psychology, it said something along the lines of, when people like Rogers and Maslow were forming the groundwork for humanistic psychology, they were doing it from very much within the framework of conventional science. They had no intention of stepping away from a scientific approach.
That's true.
And the early developments of humanistic psychology was viewed by its progenitors as being a scientific endeavor. And then something happened to it. And what this textbook was referring to was the counterculture movement. Something interesting happened on the way to the conference, this textbook said. And the something interesting, of course, was the counterculture movement, which, yeah, again, you know, that was, again, a very, you're a young person. I guess you're in your 20s during that time, and you've made some references to psychedelic experiences. Maybe you could tell us a bit about the impacts that you saw of the counterculture movement on psychology.
Well, I definitely think that it had a very strong influence. And there was some other piece of what you just said that I wanted to pick up on. I'm trying to bring it back. Oh, yes, what I wanted to say was, you're right, and the textbook was right, that the progenitors of humanistic psychology, certainly Maslow, probably Carl Rogers, and some of the others, were not interested in an anti-scientific approach or throwing over science. They thought that it was important to conduct science, although they were willing probably to accept a somewhat broader view of science and to move towards what might be called a human science.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just the counterculture, and it wasn't just psychedelics that led to the change, that led to kind of the demise, in a way, where even these intellectual pioneers of humanistic psychology began to feel disaffected with where it had gone. And what I'm referring to is what was called the human potential movement, right, which in a way was the commercialization of humanistic psychology. Mm-hmm. So that suddenly you had people who were seeing the opportunities to make money, from small amounts of money to huge amounts of money. Yeah. I'm thinking of particularly of a program called EST, Earhart Seminars Training, and some spin-off groups of that, which would, you know, that kind of thing goes on today, you know, where you see advertisements to go to a hotel for a weekend with a crowd of hundreds of other people to get trained in whether it's real estate or becoming a successful salesperson or somehow becoming a power person in one way or another. That really seemed to happen sort of to coincide as Earhart sort of picked up on a lot of the philosophical and practical ideas and exercises that were being developed in countergroups and so on, and made them commercial and got extremely successful with it. And then it got to the place where it was co-opted by the culture at large, and you began to see it mocked in, you know, newspaper articles and movies and so on. And that's one of the things that happens in today's fast-moving media culture, is you better hope that the media doesn't get onto what you're doing, because it'll use it up real fast, and we get used to things so quickly, we say, oh, that. ho-hum. It's like as soon as we can name a thing and kind of feel like we know the thing, we're kind of done with it in some respects. And I think in part that's what happened to humanistic psychology.
Right.
And it then became, with the rise of positive psychology, though, it's very interesting. And as you know, I've been intrigued by it and critical of it and enthusiastic about it all at once, is it showed that that initial impulse that grabbed us back in the 60s, that grabbed me, that hunger is still there at large. And so when I went to, I think it was the second World Congress that I went to, I missed the first one, went to the second one. There were over 1,000 psychologists there. That was like the conference that I went to in humanistic psychology back in 1969. Right. There would have been 1,000 psychologists probably at that one. Yeah. So, wow, here's this explosion of interest. You know, there's some kind of, you know, there's a hunger out there for whatever we call it to focus on the positive potential of human beings and the positive aspects that is not all negative. Yes, there is a dark side. Yes, there, you know, and I agree with Martin Seligman, you know, when he says, actually he's repeating what Maslow had essentially said, psychology has spent a lot of time exploring the dark side of human nature and all of its fallibility and psychopathology. What about the other side of the coin? So Seligman brought that back and a whole lot of great energy. But the other interesting thing is that a lot of the people who presented at that conference and who are leaders in this movement are part of my cohort. They were graduate students when I was a graduate student. Only they went on to do research and establish, you know, instead of becoming therapists, some of them became therapists, but some went on to research careers where they proceeded to validate and document a lot of the stuff. And one person you asked me about previously was ACT, what's his name, blocking on it?
Hayes?
Yeah. Yeah. What's his whole name? Hayes.
Is it Stephen Hayes?
Yeah, Stephen Hayes, who I interviewed. Yep. And, you know, in part, I think he's done 30 years of research. Leslie Greenberg's done 30 or more years of research. The guy I just interviewed on gratitude, he's been doing research before positive psychology happened on gratitude. So there were people who were interested in this, laboring in this area, for whom positive psychology then created an umbrella that they could get together under.
Yeah. Yes, it's quite fascinating, isn't it? I as a student of the 80s, I guess I sort of wistfully look back to the 60s, when humanistic psychology became a bit of a force within psychology, and my career in psychology, I guess the 3 decades that I've been involved in it, has really been a time of the cognitive behavioral revolution.
Yes.
Where, at least in Australia, cognitive behavioral psychology, CBT, RET, etc., I think has dominated psychology probably for 2 or 3 decades. And as I always had humanistic values, although I would often adopt different approaches that weren't necessarily humanistic, you know, therapeutic approaches, but the underpinning of my work has always been with humanistic values. I guess I always kind of bucked at the hardline cognitive behavioral approach, even though I see the validity in many respects of it. Mm-hmm. And I guess a cynical part of me thinks, okay, well, positive psychology is really just cognitive behavioral psychologists rediscovering humanistic psychology and repackaging it.
That could be true to some extent. You know, to some extent, I think that's true.
Which I'm very grateful for. You know, I welcome it because I think, you know, psychology really needs to rediscover a lot of humanistic psychology values and a lot of the focus in humanistic psychology. So I think it's a great evolution. But, yeah, the cynical part of me thinks, well, you know, it's always been there. You just chose to ignore it for the last 3 decades.
Yeah, well, let's hope that the underlying values that you're talking about are part of what's reborn, and and that it's, you know, carried forward by the people who are emerging, who have emerged, and who are going to emerge as flag bearers of that movement. And also, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how long, quotes, positive psychology lasts as a movement. If humanistic psychology only had a lifespan of 40 years, let's say. And of course, the roots of humanistic psychology go back much further into schools of philosophy, Heidegger and Husserl and people like that, at least that far. You know, and so some of those threads may continue, but it'd be interesting to see, you know, well, what will the fate be? You know, there's kind of a pendulum, I think, that swings back and forth. And we had, you know, in psychology, we had learning theory during the, you know, during the Skinner's heyday, everything was learning theory. Yeah. Then perception kind of moved in, and because they saw that, well, the brain starts to play a role in terms of perception, and that, and so perception became very big, and then the cognitive behavioral, the cognitive revolution, and it seems like now, you know, sort of alongside the positive psychology that we're talking about, but more on the side, on the, you know, research side, is, you know, is the emergence of this sort of neuropsychological, what it would appear to be, some kind of neuropsychological revolution of a deeper understanding of brain processes and a kind of opening of new horizons.
Yeah. And you've mentioned, you referred quite a few times in your program, seeing a confluence of all these different branches within psychology appearing to be heading towards some kind of melding together.
Yes. And it's difficult to talk about, I think. But so we have neuroscience there, you know, on the one hand, we have all of this neuroscience as a result primarily of more powerful imaging tools, I think. That's certainly maybe the biggest piece of it, along with techniques of, well, it's mostly the neuroimaging, but also there are some, you know, beginning to do brain stimulation at deeper levels of the brain, and to do monitoring at deeper levels of the brain with very fine electrodes. So I think, you know, there's new information coming from that and new therapeutic approaches. And then interestingly, we have attachment theory, which I think we're in a time where attachment theory is just, it seems to keep coming up. Attachment theory is more and more compelling. And there are different schools of psychotherapy that seem to be able to gather around the standard of attachment theory and to kind of organize themselves around that approach, I think. And we're getting validation from the neuroscience side where we can understand some of the mechanisms of attachment theory. I guess I also have to back up, too, and think of the, you know, somewhere in here to acknowledge the social, cultural, evolutionary forces that are at work and that we're understanding more and more as well. So kind of epigenetics, I think, comes in with that. Mm. We've got more research on the effectiveness of psychotherapy and all of the stuff that points to skills more than it does to schools and to theoretical orientation. Mm-hmm. We still have a big divide, I think, between the biomedical model versus the educational model, I would say, the educational / social model of that. And, you know, maybe it's not an either or. I think we're moving into a world increasingly where we have to say both and. that these mm-hmm. are, that we're talking about the same universe, and yeah. but that there are different windows into that same unit. It's like the elephant again, and so we grab different pieces of the elephant. And but one of the new things that has happened around all of that is seeing that talk therapy modifies the brain in demonstrable ways. So that kind of brings us talk therapy people into the room, into the conversation that we had been excluded from in some ways by the hard science folks, you know, saying, no, we're talking about the real stuff. We're talking about the brain.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're talking about chemicals and things like that. Well, turns out, you know, and of course it had to be so, but at least now it's demonstrable that talking and other sorts of interventions, in fact, all of experience modifies the brain, yeah. modifies those chemicals.
Yeah.
It said that it's all part of the whole. And so, their interventions will, I'm sensing that interventions will probably continue to be a mix of those two, but that the hard dividing lines between what were previously called the schools, I think those traditional barriers are breaking down, but I'm not sure that they'll ever go away completely because of the human ego, because of ego and marketing.
Yeah.
And this could open up into a whole other doorway about what's going on in psychology these days and where I see it all going. Having to do with both the marketing of psychology and the marketing of individuals. First of all, there are people with strong ego needs to make a big mark, right, and to get famous.
Yep.
And so if you patent or copyright, as people have done, or trademark the James Alexander approach, and I shouldn't have used your name because I don't see you as being somebody like that.
I'll take the free advertising.
I apologize. But there are people out there that, you know, that are doing those things to make a big name for themselves or to go down in the history books or to appear to have won some piece of the debate or to make a lot of money. All of those factors, you know, very human factors are there. Plus, there's the marketing of psychology as a whole. That's, you know, there are big factors there, and individuals' needs to make money. So, and to get famous.
Yes, there's a whole lot of factors involved beyond purely theoretical, isn't there? Or choices between theories.
Yes, and so if you don't mind, maybe I'll say a little bit more about that.
Sure.
Okay, because I gave it some thought, you know, before. Well, I knew this was coming up, so I tried to think about what I could say. So, you know, psychology is not monolithic. Years ago, I think, while I was an undergraduate or shortly before, there was a famous psychologist by the name of Sigmund Koch, and he set out to write a book about psychology. And it went into all these volumes that he never anticipated. I forget how many volumes there were. And now we have, I don't know exactly how many, but over 50 divisions of the American Psychological Association. So psychology as a whole is huge. But if we just kind of focus on psychotherapy, we have to acknowledge that whatever our theories are, that they're also, there's a larger container, that there are social, cultural, and economical forces currently impacting psychotherapy. One is what I would call the deprofessionalization. which, as I pointed out, when I got started, I had to get a PhD if I wanted to be a therapist. One of the things that's developed is that we now have master's level training and master's level licensing. I'm not against it. I'm not sure that the PhD was required, but arguably the level of preparation and so on was reduced. And in some ways, that is a trend. I think one of the ways that trend is manifesting itself is with the rise of coaching. So that coaching turns out to be an in-run around licensing. You don't have to have a license to declare yourself a coach. And in fact, there are quite a few PhD psychologists who have chosen to call themselves, or have PhDs in other fields, who choose to call themselves coaches because, A, either they don't want to have to go through the hoops of the licensing process. For example, maybe they didn't get their PhD from a school that is APA approved, internships, etc. Or, what was my other or? Or, in their assessment, coaching is more palatable to the market out there. There are a lot of people who are unwilling to admit that they need a, quote, therapist. That must mean that they have problems. I'm making air quotes, trying to do it in my voice as well. You know, that there's something wrong with them. Whereas seeing a coach, oh, well, I'm a normal person. That's a lot more appealing. Mm. So that's one force that's going on. And that could include, you know, one of the other things that goes on is that there are people who've, you know, there are a lot of sort of training programs out there that are offered sometimes by people with various kinds of licenses and credentials, but their training programs are kind of open to more or less whoever wants to take them, so that you could get maybe trained in Gestalt or bioenergetics or some other approach, some more contemporary ones that I probably don't even know about, body approaches or something, and maybe take a training that's a year long or something, but maybe one weekend. I know in the old days, in the early 70s, there were lots of people who on the basis of a few weekends then started putting a shingle out and advertising themselves as practitioners. So mm-hmm. I do think that kind of thing is going on. We have the movement. What happened was the experimentalists won the day in the university system, and I imagine that's rather true in Australia. Is it here in the U.S.? Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah, so what we had was the rise of professional schools to train people to be clinical psychologists, and those are very expensive because they're not funded by the state in the way that major universities are. So they don't have outside funding, they don't have alumni funding, so they're very expensive. So what happens is that the people who do go to those schools, and by the way, those schools are under considerable pressure. If they want to have their grads licensed, then they have to have their ear to the ground as to, okay, what are the courses that they have to have and so on. So they're subject to outside pressures. Mm-hmm. And so one of the phenomena that are going on is that students are coming out of school, people are coming out of school at the master's level and at the PhD level with huge amounts of debt. So they're saddled with debt, and their clinical decisions may be influenced by that. You know, can I afford to let this client go? Can I afford to refer this client to somebody who maybe has deeper expertise than I do? Well, I don't know. I've got $100,000 of debt. I sort of need to keep these people coming in. Yeah. That probably would not be a conscious process, but it could easily be an unconscious process. Another sociological factor is, I think, over the period of time that we've talked about, say 50s till now, a huge influx of women. into higher education generally, but also into psychology and into training in psychotherapy. In some ways, I think they're better suited. I think that they're more attuned to being deep listeners and having that empathy and almost radar, you know, for the kinds of issues that people have. So that's wonderful. But one of the things that goes along with it, too, is, you know, due to the power and economic differential, they're often willing to work for less. So there is a whole sort of with the insurance industry, and that's the other huge factor, they're driving things. Therapy's got to be quicker, shorter, and cheaper. And so that's influencing us all at one level or another.
Yeah.
Another factor is graduate schools are overproducing PhDs. They're producing too many PhDs and training them to be professors. They're training them to be scientists and professors. And guess what? There aren't that many jobs out there for professor scientists. And so then they're casting about to create new professions like coaching and others to create work for themselves.
Yeah.
Without an eye to the competition in private practice, which is hugely competitive, at least in major cities and maybe many minor cities here. I don't know how it is in Australia. Are there lots of therapists competing with each other there?
Yes, it is competitive, yeah.
Yeah, it's a big country, but the populations are concentrated.
That's correct.
Yeah, and also over here with little or no business training. There was no business training when I was in graduate school, and according to one of my friends, there still isn't. But if you go into private practice, you're opening a business. So many people are going into that not realizing that they're going to go into business, and it's not easy, and they may have to borrow money to do it, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So and then there's the pressure for evidence-based treatments, which we've gone into in some of the interviews. And while, you know, at one level, I've got mixed feelings about that. At one level, I applaud the notion that there should be some kind of evidence that the things that we do work on the one hand. On the other hand, it can be very limiting in terms of what it accepts, and it's very expensive to do double-blind studies.
I think it's also what does that requirement do to innovation? There was a point where what Carl Rogers was doing, what Carl Jung was doing, what Freud was doing, had no evidence base at all. You know, in all the beginnings of all the major people in our field, at some point there was no evidence base for what they were doing whatsoever. They were innovators.
Good point.
We obviously need to always have an innovative edge in our profession to keep on developing. And I do have a concern that a strict emphasis on evidence base can stymie innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I agree.
Dr. Dave, I'm keeping an eye on the clock, and we're pretty well running close to an hour, so I think perhaps we need to wind it up here. I find it fascinating to talk to you, and I guess occurred to me during the course of our conversation why I find it so fascinating and enjoyable talking to you. Firstly, you're an erudite speaker, and it's always pleasurable just to listen to you. Secondly, you've got a fascinating history, and I think your professional career in psychology has really mirrored a very interesting era in the development of psychology. You were there, as in many of the social phenomena that you described earlier, at the ground level, and your development of your career in psychology has really paralleled the development of psychology in our culture, which is just very fascinating. And thirdly, you're probably about the most well-read psychologist I've ever come across. You must be plowing through a book a week.
I am.
I don't think there's anybody else on the planet that has their finger on the pulse to the extent that you do, the pulse of psychology. So I note also that I've managed to perhaps cover or ask you about a quarter of the questions that I had sketched out. And we could obviously talk for days, and I don't think we're going to get the opportunity to talk for days, but I think you'll find that many of the listeners are also equally fascinated by your experiences and your observations. So I thank you very much for your time, and more broadly, thank you very much for your program. You know, you do receive lots of very well-deserved praise, and it's all extremely genuine from the people that offer it, because you are creating and offering a magnificent resource for people all over the world. So thank you again for your time, and thank you again for your program.
Well, thank you very much for creating this opportunity, and I'm really glad you kind of pressed me for it. And also, I feel so lucky to be in this catbird seat, maybe is the phrase, this vantage point of monitoring psychology and interviewing all these people from diverse perspectives. That is pretty unique and is further evidence of what I started the interview out saying, that I seem to have this instinct for getting in the right place. And it feels like, wow, this was, you know, because when I started out, I had no idea whether anybody was going to listen or not. And so it's been so gratifying to hear from so many listeners out there to how much this has spoken to them. And so again, I just have to thank my, we didn't talk about my Jungian interests, but that piece of that Jungian unconscious that seems to be guiding me.
There's a lot more that we could talk about, and who knows, maybe we'll get another opportunity if I can sufficiently bend your arm again.
Okay, thanks again. I hope you enjoyed listening to this interview. I was shy about doing it, fearing I'd have little to say. But thanks to Dr. Alexander's good questions, turns out there was no problem with that. In fact, I talked so much that we ran out of time. I hope that at least some of it was new information for you. In the interview, I mentioned several times my youthful rejection of the psychoanalytic perspective in graduate school. If you're a regular listener, you'll know that I later came back around, recognizing that contemporary psychodynamic theory provides the most comprehensive theory of personality and psychopathology, in my opinion, and that of many others. And under the psychodynamic rubric, I include both attachment theory and Jungian psychology. Thanks again to Dr. Alexander for suggesting this interview and for drawing me out.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Adam from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a long-time listener for over 7 years, and finally I think it's time to back up my appreciation of Shrink Wrap Radio with a donation. You provide such a wonderful, stimulating podcast, and you deserve to have this supported financially by your loyal listeners like me. And you're right, donating to Shrink Wrap Radio made me feel great. So I encourage other listeners to donate and keep supporting your unique podcast. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Adam. Allow me to say that Aussies rule, and I'm glad to have so many very sharp and loyal Australian listeners to this show. Once again, I don't have much in the way of announcements today other than to say we have no new transcripts on the site. If you'd like to volunteer to transcribe one of your favorite episodes, please drop me an email letting me know. If you go to the transcripts tab on our site, you can see which shows have been transcribed already and which are missing. You'll see that many of our interviews have been transcribed, and that's all been the result of volunteers such as yourself. Let me remind you that it's not too late to take part in the 10-session discussion that Jungian analysts Pat Berry and Robbie Bosnack are having on James Hillman and alchemy. You can participate live in the remaining sessions or receive the audio recordings of the entire series. In addition, there are CE units available for this experience. Be sure to take advantage of my discount code to save 15%. That code is Dr. Dave, which has to be spelled D-R-D-A-V-E, no punctuation. I think it's an excellent value and encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity. To get all the details and to sign up, please click on the banner ad or the Jung platform in the left-hand sidebar of our site. Also, don't forget about the International Association for the Study of Dreams conference in Berkeley, California, running June 4 through June 8th of 2014. It's open to all, and I hope to see you there. Click on the link in the left-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com for full details and registration info. Finally, if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that there is an app for that, which is to say, we have an app for listening to the most recent 75 Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on your iOS or Android device. Just click on the Apps tab at the top of the homepage on shrinkwrapradio.com for full details.
It's Jeff and Carl Jung saying, you're on the couch with Dr. Dave. Your thoughts on the show, Carl?
I think there will be a reaction. A great change of our psychological attitude is imminent. That is certain.
Right on then. Take it away, Dr. Dave.
Hey, if any of you out there have audio skills, I could sure use some more cute little transitions like this one that you just heard. We're running a bit long, so I will share just one email, and it comes from Peter B. Todd, a longtime listener, financial supporter, and also guest from episode number 240, Unconscious Mental Factors in HIV Infection. And Peter writes, Dear David, I have some great news to share with you and your Jungian audience. I am presenting a global webinar titled The Entangled State of God and Humanity, organized by the Asheville Jung Center. The link is http://ashevillejungcenter.org/webinars/w24/. He goes on to say, I'm proudly grateful for your generous endorsement of my book, which is now the primary source material for the webinar, as you will see from the abstract. I do hope that it is illuminating and enjoyable for you and your colleagues. Warm regards, Peter B. Todd. So that will have to wrap it up for listener emails. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. In addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-309-4707. You can also leave voicemails using that iPhone/Android app I mentioned, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks to Dr. James Alexander once again for interviewing me, and be sure to listen next time when my return guest will be psychologist and professor Dr. Tobin Hart. He was my guest way back on Shrink Wrap Radio number 89, The Secret Spiritual World of Children. Now, people frequently ask me who was my favorite guest or which was my favorite interview. There have been too many good ones for me to single one out. But I have to say, that interview with Dr. Hart always comes to mind and would be right up there, which is why I leapt at the chance to interview him again about his new book, The Four Virtues, Presence, Heart, Wisdom, and Creation. So I hope you'll join us next time. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. And I think it would be appropriate to usher you out with a splendid duet by Dr. James Alexander and myself.
I've been doing some hard traveling, I thought you know. I've been doing some hard traveling way down the road. With a heavy heart and a worried mind, Shrink Wrap Radio's a real good find. I've been doing some hard traveling, Lord. He's been doing some good listening, I thought you knowed. Dr. Dave's been podcasting way down the road.
with a big fat mic and a soothing voice. You know he's offered you a real good choice. He's been doing some podcasting, love. I've been doing some deep traveling, I thought you'd know. I've been doing some deep exploring way down the road. With a happy heart and a bright spirit, life's calling me, ain't gonna fear it. I've been doing some deep traveling, love. I've been doing some wide exploring, I thought you'd know. I've been doing some self-exploring way down the road. With Jung and Freud and soul and psyche, Dr. Dave's in my ear guide. We've been doing some wide traveling, love.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.